Moving into item number three, something that I think we're all looking forward to, wildlife governance principles briefing. And Chris, I want to thank you for making your way west, go west, young man, and sharing that with us. This is something that we've been talking with amongst ourselves about for a while, so thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and visit with you. I had the privilege of meeting a couple of you at the Washington Wildlife Leaders Forum a few years ago, and have met many of the staff and some of the commissioners through Western Association meetings and so forth. I was really impressed with the discussions earlier today. I mean, you guys are clearly out there and doing some really good work. So, while this is billed as a presentation, I hope it's more of a dialogue than a presentation, because I certainly don't feel like I'm coming here with all of the answers and going to lay out a crystal clear path for you. I think what I'm hoping is that I can share some of my experience, some of my perspectives from interacting with other states in ways that may help you deal with some of the issues that you're wrestling with here. To provide some background for those of you who don't know me, my first career was with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I started there as a fisheries technician on Kodiak in 1973, worked my way up through the ranks over the course of many years to the assistant director of Wildlife Division, retired from Alaska in 1998, and went to Montana to serve as the deputy director of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks for the state of Montana. Did that for 13 years and then failed retirement for the second time when I joined the Wildlife Management Institute. And the institute was established in 1911 with the mission to enhance the professional conservation and management of North America's wildlife. And that remains our mission today. We're a small group composed of folks like myself who've had a variety of experiences, made lots of mistakes, and generally get paid to tell people how not to screw up the same way we did, because there's lots of new ways you can make your own mistakes. So one of the things that has been fascinating to me, particularly in the last 8 or 10 years, is this notion of governance, the role of public trust responsibilities, the role of agency professionals versus folks like yourself who are in elected or appointed positions and making decisions. And I've been working with a group of colleagues, including Dan Decker from Cornell University and a number of professionals from other state agencies, exploring these ideas and formulating what we termed wildlife governance principles. And I'll get to that a bit later in the discussion. But I want to provide some background and context to lead us up to that point. So if this thing works, Tammy, did I just click it?
Yep.
Okay. So to begin with, I just want to start out by saying that when I use the term governance, what I'm really talking about is the practices and processes that determine how decisions are made and how responsibilities are exercised. Okay. This is different than the statutes per se that govern the role or define the limits of the authority of an agency or the commission. It's really more about the nuts and bolts of how you go about making your decisions and working on a day-to-day basis. So that's what I mean there. And in deference to Bill and to the chair, since I am not an attorney and I've gotten in trouble in the past for throwing the term public trust doctrine around, and in fact, when Steve Williams, the Institute president, was giving a similar presentation in Florida, he made a comment about the public trust doctrine in Washington State, and a former attorney from Washington who was there in the audience took some umbrage at that because, in his opinion, there was no public trust doctrine with respect to fish and wildlife in the state of Washington. So the way the group that I've been working with has resolved that issue is to clarify the difference between public trust thinking, which is a general philosophy with respect to how natural resources are used and managed, versus the public trust doctrine, which represents the codified or case law that applies in a specific jurisdiction. So I'll be using the term public trust thinking generally rather than public trust doctrine per se. When we think of fish and wildlife management in the context of managing under public trust thinking, they're really the three key elements that are involved are the assets, the fish and wildlife resources, the habitat that those critters rely on, the trust administrators whose role is to manage the trust, allocate benefits from the trust, and so forth, and then the beneficiaries, meaning the public, all of the public that you serve. And as I was listening to your discussion about the relative importance of conservation versus providing opportunity, which is a common dilemma that folks in this business wrestle with, I would just offer that, and perhaps another way to think about that, rather than wrestling with which takes precedence over the other, is to think of it in the context of managing a trust for beneficiaries that include both current and future generations. And so as trustees, you have obligations to current generations and an obligation to be providing benefits from the assets to the current generation of Washingtonians, but you also have an obligation to future generations. And so the decisions that you're making today in allocating those benefits from the resources have to maintain options for meeting the needs of folks in the future. One other thing I'd like to talk about is the difference between the roles and responsibilities of trustees versus trust managers. And this stems from some work that I did and a paper I published back in 2011 that talked specifically about the roles of state agency professionals. And the goal of that paper was to clarify the difference between the responsibilities that elected and appointed officials, such as yourselves, have, which really are the highest level fiduciary responsibility to the beneficiaries of the Fish and Wildlife Trust. You're making the highest level policy decisions, as you were just discussing a little bit ago, making those decisions that allocate benefits out to the beneficiaries, and you are accountable to the people directly in a way that your staff are not. Okay? The trust managers, on the other hand, have primarily ministerial or executive responsibilities, or be recommending policy but not making decisions outside of whatever sideboards you might delegate to them. They obviously have to monitor the resources, identify what benefits your public want, and they're really accountable to you. And it's important, in my experience, that particularly trust managers continue to operate within their role and don't stray into the role of trustees. And that can be really difficult for folks, particularly in the field, who are sometimes dragged in that direction by public who want to hold them accountable for decisions that you make. And how you address that tension with staff as you work through things can be challenging, but something to think about. So let me step back now and talk about the evolution of conservation, just to provide some context for why governance and being conscious about your governance is more important now than perhaps it has ever been in the past. You think about the earliest era of conservation in the late 1800s and early 1900s was really about preserving and protecting what was left after a century or so of largely unregulated exploitation. Populations and habitats had been decimated. So the initial conservation effort was really focused on hanging on to those last remnants. And so the focus was primarily on regulation and law enforcement, figuring out how to stop those forces that were having those adverse impacts. So at that point, in that time, in terms of how decisions were made or how responsibilities were exercised, things were pretty simple. You know, you were trying to stop the bleeding and get the patients into the emergency room. Then as we moved more toward the mid-century period, we evolved into the scientific management era when fisheries science and wildlife science were being applied. We learned more about how systems worked and began to implement practices focused on propagation, restoration of populations. The management, though, and the conservation at that time was really driven still by a largely utilitarian ethic. And you think back to some of particularly Leopold's early definitions of game management, talking about working to make the land produce sustainable crops of fish and wildlife for recreation and so forth. That was, for some of us who actually worked in part of that era, kind of the golden, good old days, you know, when things were pretty relatively simple. We were focused on enhancing populations, providing maximum opportunities for hunters and anglers. And it was a time when expertise was accepted or respected or even expected of agencies, and the public gave quite a bit of deference to professionals in making decisions. I think it was Commissioner Grable who made the comment about the time when, you know, science was what wildlife management or fisheries management was based on. And I used to think that way too, but I think in reality, even at those times, you know, clearly politics and values were influencing decisions. It was just a much narrower range of politics and values, and because many of the managers as well as the users and the beneficiaries that were really engaged had similar values and didn't have a lot of value conflicts, a lot of that was just subconscious. And so the science appeared to be a more significant and driving factor. But that's not the way things are today. You think about where we sit today and how things have changed, particularly since the 1970s, through the course of most of my career, the roles and responsibilities of agencies have greatly expanded. They've taken on endangered species. They've taken on non-game species, taken on much larger scale habitat restoration projects dealing with a much broader scope of conservation challenges than historically. There's also been a tremendous increase in stakeholder involvement. In Montana, we used to be able to go into a community and there'd be a rod and gun club, and now you have Trout Unlimited, Walleyes Unlimited, you know, the muzzleloader groups, the archery groups, the traditional archery groups, and that's not to mention all of the groups that aren't associated with hunting or angling or so forth. And as a society, our values are changing, and the interests that people have in hunting and or in fish and wildlife are changing. All of that creates a much more complex decision environment for all of us to work in. At the same time, over the past 30 to 40 years, there's been a huge erosion in public trust in government. Most of that occurred during the 70s, but generally over the course of the last 40 years, people have become more and more skeptical. I used to think that when those of us who lived through the 60s said never trust anybody over 35, the fact that we're all in our 60s or 70s now hasn't changed that. We still don't trust anybody over 35. And probably don't trust many under 35 either. This is just another factor that influences the environment that we all have to work in. Nate mentioned license sales and in the traditional model that most state fish and wildlife agencies have operated under, where license revenue and matching federal funds from Pittman Robertson and Dingell Johnson Wallop Brough have been really the lifeblood of the agencies. And that is probably not a viable model over the long term. And ignoring the practicality of it, I really question whether it's equitable. If, in fact, wildlife conservation, fish and wildlife conservation, and the job that you do is providing benefits to all of Washington's citizens, then to me it's really inequitable to expect a small and declining portion of the population to be paying the majority of that share of the cost associated with that. Sure, you're all aware. I mean, you've got demographic changes going on in Washington, as we're seeing, all across the country, with increasing population, aging populations, increasing minorities, increasing cultural diversity. All of these things are impacting your role, but they also reflect the changes in the beneficiary base that you're responsible to. And so you need to recognize and be able to address those changes in terms of how you manage and allocate benefits from the fish and wildlife assets. Increasing urbanization, technological innovation, detachment from nature, all of these are things that are affecting you. And it really raises a question that we've discussed in a number of times as to whether or not conservation is really relevant to the larger public. And if you think about it, I mean, think about the trends in funding and the priorities for federal agencies and the challenges that the legislature has laid out to you in terms of the proviso. If conservation was as important to the legislature as education or infrastructure, would they be asking those same kind of questions or posing those same sort of challenges to your agency? There are very few states have been able to implement alternative funding mechanisms the bill that's in Congress right now to establish a broader funding base for state agencies is at least the second bite at the apple in my career. And the first one fell far short of what everyone hoped for. Efforts to transfer federal lands from the federal domain to the state reflects in some people's view a lack of recognition of the value of those lands and their contributions to conservation, and the lack of just the lack of citizens' recognition of the job that you do beyond those folks who are really engaged and affected by the decisions that you make on whether or not you can use primers in muzzle loaders, or whether the allocation to the seiners is different than to the trollers. Those groups obviously have a significant stake and remain engaged with your process. But if we can't figure out a way to address and engage the broader public, then it's going to be really difficult to change the dynamics of the trajectory that all of us in this business are in. I think another part of the challenge that we face reflects the way we think about conservation versus the way many in the public think of conservation. You know, those of us who are involved, either as professionals or yourself as commissioners, focus on population management and control, protection of sensitive species, hunting and fishing participation or regulations, you know, sustainable yields. Those are the kind of terms and the concepts that frequently color our language and are top of mind for us. But for many in the public, that's not the way they think of it. When they think about conservation, they think about things like air and water quality, public health, climate regulation, caring for wildlife, physical and mental well-being. So they've got a somewhat different mindset or way of thinking about conservation that sometimes creates communication challenges. So what do we do? What do you about that? Do state agencies resist all of these trends and try to go back to the way things used to be? Or do we try to figure out how to adapt? How do we move forward and use some of this energy that's out there in the public in order to survive and thrive in the future? As we've thought about this, our advice has always been to figure out how to move forward, not to try to push against the tide and go backwards. That brings up the question then, okay, if we're going to change, what do we need to change? Or how do we need to realign governance and the things we're doing on a day-to-day basis in order to adapt to the challenges that we have? In general, a couple of the things that we've identified are to move from relatively narrow focus on specific species or types of uses or user groups to a much broader perspective, to adapt from having static priorities to being adaptable and meeting modern challenges. And the discussion that you all just had was tremendous in that respect, in terms of thinking about as you're facing this legislative challenge that's been handed to you with respect to your budget, what are your priorities? How are you going to adapt those to meet the challenges in the future? And shifting from being in a situation where your relevance to society is declining with that smaller and smaller user group, traditional user groups, to one where you're valued and supported more broadly by the by all of your constituents. Now, one thing that I always try to point out is that this does not need to be a zero-sum game. And oftentimes, I have gotten pushback, and certainly when I was in my role as deputy director at Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and trying to bring new constituents and new interests into the decision-making process, some of the folks who had always had a seat at the table viewed this as a zero-sum game and felt that there was no way that somebody else could be allowed to have a stake in a decision without taking away something from them. One of the things I've wanted to do for a long time is put together a paper that draws an analogy between broadening the stakeholder involvement, bringing more interest to the table, and a family that's bringing their second child into the family. Because there, in many ways, there are some parallels, if you think about that. Any of you that have multiple children, you know, when you had your first child, that child was the center of your universe, and from their perspective, they had your undivided attention. You know, when you got pregnant the second time and brought that second child into the family, that fundamentally changed the relationship between parent and child, and the parents and the first child. It didn't mean the parents love them any less. You know, the family was richer because there were more members in it. So we've adopted this slogan, none left out and none left behind, to represent that and to try to reassure some of those traditional constituency groups that just because we're paying more attention to other interests doesn't mean that we're walking away from them. So that's an important part of what wouldn't change. As we worked through all this, then the next question was, okay, if we're going to change, what's going to guide that change? How are we going to ensure that we can address the needs of all of our constituents without abandoning those of the needs of our traditional constituents? And the way we came about doing that was to combine elements of public trust thinking, which is this ancient philosophy that we've found applies across cultures and time, and really seems to be fundamental to human thinking, with current expectations or norms for good governance. And so we brought those two things together to create the set of wildlife governance principles that lay out the foundation for decision making. Public trust thinking, in its simplest form, simply reflects that fish and wildlife are resources that are an endowment. Okay. There's an obligation to steward those resources, use them and benefit from them now, but also pass them on to future generations. That fish and wildlife resources are not suited for private ownership, that you cannot take a particular fish stock or wildlife population and turn that over to a public or to a private entity without losing the public's opportunity to benefit from that. All citizens deserve fair consideration in decision making. Decisions you make today should avoid foreclosing options for the future. Trust administrators should be transparent, and that citizens can hold trustees accountable. So those are the basic elements that some colleagues at Cornell, in looking at the literature and looking at cultures, as I said, around the globe and through time, found those things to be very common. In terms of what people in modern society expect terms of governance. They expect government to be responsive, to have the opportunity to participate in decision-making, for decision-making to be transparent, for decisions to be equitable and inclusive, or decision-making to be equitable and inclusive. Consensus-oriented, which doesn't mean that every decision ends up in a consensus outcome, but to the extent you can meet the broadest range of interests, try to do that. Government is accountable to the public, and it's efficient and effective in use of public resources. So we sat down with a group of folks representing a number of state agencies, academics, some federal agency folks, and talked about, okay, if we were going to blend those two lines of thought together, how would we articulate in a few statements guidance relative to those ways of thinking? And what we came up with were 10 wildlife governance principles. And it was funny, we started out, I think initially we had 12 or 13 statements, and then we whittled it down to 7 or 8, and then through a series of iterations with a couple of different workshops, wound up coming back to 10. And couldn't figure out, why did we end up with 10 principles? Anyway, that's what we had. And these are normative, aspirational statements. They're not prescriptive. They don't tell you exactly what to do. But they provide some general guidance. It's designed to improve the practices and procedures, your governance, increase the quality and quantity of stakeholder involvement and engagement in decision-making, to increase the diversity of the input to your decisions, and to increase the adaptability and relevance of the agency and the commission as you're working through these. And they're really designed to focus on and support 5 areas: strategic thinking and organizational adaptability. Because in view of the challenges that you have, as you were just discussing earlier, you really need to be thinking strategically, and you have to adapt the organization to meet the challenges. And I think it was Nate that was posing the question earlier today. If you need more economic information in order to improve your decision-making, that's not a skill set that very many state fish and wildlife agencies have. So that may require changes either in agency structure or in the relationship between the agency and an entity, whether that's University of Washington or private consultants, whoever, who can provide that sort of information and bring that sort of information to you. Another area that principles support is evidence-based and broadly informed decision-making. Okay. The more evidence you can bring and the more diverse types of information you can bring to decision-making, the more robust your decisions are likely to be. The principles also help ensure inclusivity and diversity of thought in your decision making. They focus on your decision making processes being transparent and accountable to the public. And they also address the capacity for conservation, the need for you and the agency to rely on the ability of others to help you fulfill your mission. Okay. Build on collaboration. And Nate shared with me the department's conservation initiative and guiding principles, which emphasizes collaboration. And really, these principles align very well with the wildlife governance principles. So I can just run through what we came up with, and if you have any questions or observations on these as we go through them, please raise those. First is that governance will be adaptable and responsive to citizens' current needs and interests while also being forward-looking to conserve options for future generations. That aligns perfectly with the mission and the statutes that you were reading together earlier. Second is that you will seek and incorporate multiple and diverse perspectives. And what we're getting at there is that simply having opportunities for the public to come to your meetings often is not going to be enough. And this morning or earlier this afternoon, you were discussing the challenges associated with getting the public to come to your meetings and making your meetings accessible to the public. And all of that is really important. But one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that public meetings only provide one mechanism, and oftentimes not the best mechanism, to really understand what your constituents think or want. And so seeking out that information through active human dimensions research or other ways to engage with the public can be really important for an agency. Governance will apply social and ecological science, citizens' knowledge, and trust administrators' judgment. This gets back to the Commissioner Graybill's point. There's a lot of different types of science that's out there, and that's all critically important. Citizens' knowledge is important, but in the final, you know, when the rubber hits the road, it really is your judgment and how you interpret that information and the values that you all bring to the table that affect the decisions. Governance will produce multiple sustainable benefits for all beneficiaries. So rather than focusing on or disproportionately benefiting one set of users over another or systemically benefiting one interest, you really need to be conscious about all the beneficiaries. Governance should ensure that trust administrators are responsible for maintaining trust resources and allocating benefits. In some cases, the authorities that you have may not be sufficient in order to maintain trust resources. So that may be an issue where you need to talk to the legislature about your ability to make decisions that have direct impact on fish and wildlife. Governance obviously needs to be accessible and transparent, and I think, you know, from what I've heard, you guys are well on top of that. Governance should ensure that administrators are publicly accountable. I suspect that based on my experience with other commissioners and just listening to a little bit of your discussions, that you certainly feel like you're accountable to the public. They know how to get a hold of you and address any concerns that they have. And includes means for citizens to become informed and engaged in the decision making. So again, beyond simply having public meetings, finding opportunities or ways to engage people, make sure they are fully informed and engaged in decision making is important. Governance should include opportunities for administrators to meet their obligation in partnership with non-governmental entities, and that includes everything from you know, a habitat restoration project you undertake with TU or the National Wild Turkey Federation, or efforts that you make with private landowners to conserve habitat or provide access on private lands. All of those are non-government entities that you work with. And then finally, governance should facilitate collaboration and coordination across ecological, jurisdictional and ownership boundaries. We can't continue to operate in silos within agencies or have turf battles between agencies or make decisions based on small parcels of ground. We have to think at a landscape scale and work effectively across disciplines. So once we developed those principles, we thought, okay, well, this is great. We've got this lofty set of principles. How does anybody make use of this? How do we make this real or provide a mechanism whereby an agency can evaluate the extent to which they're actually aligned with those principles? So we set about exploring the relationship between principles, which are these high-level normative, you know, aspirational statements, and practices, the things that people are doing out there every day on the ground. And we identified this relationship between these principles, the five themes that I mentioned, that they relate to strategic thinking, inclusivity, those sort of things, the traits that an agency has, and then the specific behaviors, the practices that an agency undertakes on a day-to-day basis. And just to illustrate, give you a couple of examples. One of the principles is that wildlife governance will be adaptable and responsive to citizens' current needs and interests, while also being forward-looking to conserve options for future generations. That relates to this, the theme of strategic thinking and organizational adaptability. So if you think about that theme, one of the traits of an agency might be whether it's a proactive agency or whether it's reactive. Does it think strategically, or is it simply reacting to things that are coming at it? And a practice that can affect that trait of being proactive or reactive is whether or not the agency uses strategic planning tools to set realistic goals. Okay. Another example would be wildlife governance will apply social and ecological science, citizens' knowledge, and trust administrators' judgment, relating to the theme of evidence-based and broadly informed decision-making. A trait would be, are agency decisions informed by facts, or are decisions unduly influenced by politics? And a practice that would influence that trait would be informing decisions with data and supportive evidence. Another example, governance will include opportunities for trust administrators to meet their obligations in partnership with non-governmental entities, relating to the theme of the capacity for conservation. Trait being, is an agency collaborative? Is it cooperative? Does it work well, play well with others? Or is it isolated, uncooperative, resistant to influence from others? And a practice would be partnering with other agencies or NGOs to increase capacity. So we sat down and developed a list of 32 agency traits and 66 practices that we felt would be indicative of whether or not an agency was well aligned with the wildlife governance principles or not so well aligned with those principles. We worked with the state of Montana, state of New York, state of Michigan, the state of Florida in a pilot project testing these and adapting these practices and evaluating how well they relate to the principles. Developed an online survey tool that we administered to folks within the agency at the middle and upper levels, asking them to rate the agency with respect to those practices and traits both in terms of how important they felt that practice was in their particular setting, and how satisfied they were with the agency's performance with respect to that particular practice. When we get back the results, what that allows us to do in working with the agency then is to sit down and identify in that lower right-hand quadrant, those are the practices that the agency identified as being most important and with which they had the least satisfaction in terms of the degree to which they were aligned with those practices. Okay? So it gave them a starting point of focus for addressing practices which could influence the traits and improve their alignment with the wildlife governance principles. It's just one way to think about how you might apply those principles. You know, you ask the question, and oftentimes, can we afford to wait? Can we continue to operate the way we have been operating and hope that we'll just kind of muddle through? I don't think we can. As a conservation institution, I think it's important that we figure out how to move forward. And lastly, I guess I would just leave you with, you know, one of the challenges you were discussing earlier and was the focus of the leaders forum was how do we broaden and develop more sustainable funding for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Being aware of the changes that you're facing is a first step. Incorporating additional social factors and interests into agency decisions, changing decision-making and structures in response to those things, making sure you're defining relevance and meeting people where they are in terms of what they think about in terms of conservation, focusing on things like quality of life, economic benefits, public health benefits, those sorts of things, are ways that you can increase public awareness, public engagement with the department and the commission of what you're doing. And that really, to me, I think that is the key to sustainable funding, because you've got to build that public support into what you're doing in order to get to that end goal. So, with that, hit me with questions.
Very enlightening. Good stuff to hear.
A lot to absorb.
Yeah, a lot to absorb. questions, comments?
Yeah, I've got a question.
Yep.
I can start.
You got some time?
I've got as much time as you do.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, really, really great stuff to think about. So I think of this, these three states on the Pacific coast is a little bit different than other Western states in terms of our urban-rural divide. State of Jefferson, we're going to have secession in Northern California. And we talk about the Cascade Curtain here. Wolves, perfect example. Really strong conservation organization sitting here in the blue side of the state, not here, but the other side of the Cascades. Yeah. We're usually sitting there. And it really feeds that distrust that our traditional constituents feel as we try to broaden the tent.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had success in this environment? Because I just feel it's a huge challenge in these three states. Montana's different.
It is. We don't have as stark a divide between the urban and rural communities as exists in Washington and Oregon in particular. Although, you know, it does exist to some extent. You know, Missoula is pretty different than Glendive.
Yeah.
That's an issue. I've worked with the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee for 13 years as deputy director. I've represented Montana on that on the committee. When I retired and moved over to the Institute, I continued to work very closely with the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee, helping initially to develop their information an education outreach plan, and then helping to implement that plan for the last 7 years. And certainly the issue of what to do with the North Cascades has been a large part of that. And, you know, there are some who have said, well, we just need to put this to a vote, because you can see every vote you need to win that issue from the top of the Space Needle. But that's not a good way to make a decision if you want to have the people who are going to be affected by that decision on the east side of the divide buy into it. My experience one of my experiences in Alaska provided really insight in terms of how to deal with that issue, and it wasn't on a rural-urban divide per se, but many of the issues were the same. When we were, early in my career in Alaska, wolf management was not very controversial. When we needed to control a wolf population, we put a couple of biologists in some helicopters, and we went out there, and we dealt with the issue. By the mid to latter part of my career, that was not the case. It had become very controversial. We had strongly opposed opinions within the state, and the agency was really stuck in the middle. We initially thought, well, we'll develop a wolf management plan, we'll put it out, we'll get public review, we'll take the input, we'll make a decision, and if everybody across the spectrum hates it equally, then we must be doing the right thing. We tried that, and after, you know, one or two failed attempts, decided there's got to be a different way to approach this. And so that was the first time that we pulled together a citizen stakeholder group that represented the full spectrum of values with respect to wolf management. At one end of the spectrum, we had a young woman who was the executive director of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, the most avid pro-wolf organization in the state. And at the other end, we had a fellow who was probably the most effective land-and-shoot wolf hunter that ever existed. And we brought that group together, gave them the charge, and what we basically said to this group of 13 individuals representing the spectrum was, we can't make all of you happy, and we don't want to try to be Solomon and cut the baby anymore. What we want is we want you to sit down, talk among yourselves, recognize that if I make you happy, I'm not going to make him happy. Okay? And I have an obligation as a manager to all of you, and you guys need to collectively start thinking about what's realistic. At the first meeting, Valerie sat, you know, on one end of the table, and Chuck sat on the other end of the table, and they just sat there with arms crossed, and they just glared at each other. By the time that group met for the third time, Chuck and Valerie, by choice, sat side by side at the table. And whenever we were dealing with a really tough issue, you could see Valerie and Chuck leaning over and having a side conversation. And when that happened, the rest of the committee just kind of sat back and waited. because they knew if Chuck and Valerie could agree on principles for how to resolve a problem, then everybody else was going to be bought in totally, because they were the polar opposites. What led to that was their ability to recognize each other as individuals. They were no longer some faceless representative of an environmental group or some bloodthirsty killer. They were a real person. And so in terms of addressing this east-west divide that you have, the rural-urban divide, I would suggest that you think about ways to bring influential people from those communities together and address, you know, try to reverse the polarization that you and I were discussing briefly earlier, Mr. Chairman. This, you know, people have become so alienated, and through social media, it's so easy to throw bombs and to be critical and to be disrespectful. And until we can find ways to rebuild that respect, rebuild that trust, it's going to be really tough to address those issues.
Let me just pick up on that, continue in that theme. I know in Michigan, you know, they wanted to take out a few wolves in the Upper Peninsula. It was all set to go after the first year, and then it went to the initiative when that was then killed, or can't use that word, I guess, eliminated from the as an option. That sort of thing, just like the east-west here or wherever. My pet peeve is about, not pet peeve, but the next generation coming up that understands nature less and less. And so if you have an answer for this, I will come down and bow. But is what do you see that polarization is one thing, but alienation of by demographics is growing, that we're going to have more of that policy by initiative, by an electorate growing up that has no interest or appreciation, like you show. So what, are there states that you think are really engaging youth in a positive way that we could look to?
There are some. Missouri has a great program, in part because they have for a long time had a much broader funding base, and so they've developed education centers. What I would point to and suggest that you could use as a resource and a reference was a recent study that that Dave Case and Steve Kellert did, that looked at the disconnect between nature and our society. What they found was that there's still a profound interest in and appreciation of nature and wildlife. But in many cases, particularly in the urban environment, our urban population views or thinks about nature in a very different way. And sometimes the way we communicate or portray nature is not helpful in terms of reversing the trends that we're seeing. In many cases, when we talk about fish and wildlife and opportunities to experience nature, those are colored by our experiences and the way we interact with nature. You know, I love to go out on the Blackfoot all by myself and spend a day fly fishing or hike up into the Bob Marshall Wilderness to hunt elk. But for a kid in downtown Seattle, I mean, the ability to go out into a park and watch bugs crawl around may be an important opportunity for that child to understand a part of nature and to feel an important part of that. So there are a number of recommendations and suggestions in that work that Dave did that agencies can use to help structure outreach programs to reach youth in particular and in underserved environments.
I'd love this dialogue to go on for, but I got to share you.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you. As in all talks, you come away with something. So the two things I came away with that were things to think about for me and I really enjoyed was the none left out and none left behind. That just makes so much sense in so many aspects of what we're trying to do with consumers and non-consumers and watchers and hunters and commercial and rec, you know, and it was just, that was really good and profound. But more importantly to me that really struck a chord was you mentioned the goal of organizations like this and entities like this is to manage the resources so they benefit current and future generations. And that really got me thinking because sometimes I think we take it on ourselves to protect the commercial fishing industry, to protect the ranching industry from wolves. You know, they're having damage. And those are all good goals, and there are things we should consider and be aware of. But our mandate is to protect those resources for future and current and future generations. And we don't know the value future generations will put on a wolf. We don't know the value of what a future generation will put on just being able to see one species of salmon that almost went extinct still there. You know, and that hit me. It's like sometimes we do get caught up in the currents of, you know, conditions of today because we hear so much. And there's not a meeting that goes by we don't hear that you know, my granddad did it this way and we want to preserve this for our grandkids. And that, you know, it's heartfelt and we listen to that. But it really hit me that, you know, our mandate is to manage those resources. We don't know what future generations value they're going to put on them. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
Down that way.
I have a question. Again, thank you very much. Very enlightening and I think very timely with our discussions that we had today. So one, it's, you know, and you probably experienced this in your career. One of the toughest things that an agency deals with, a commission, are allocation of resources. And oftentimes we hear from stakeholders and also amongst ourselves, it's like, well, we should manage these resources based on, or allocate, I should say, allocate resources based on the economic benefit returned, you know, to however you define that, you know, and that's another issue for another topic. So I guess my question is how does that fit, you know, is that consistent management for economic benefit? Is that consistent with the public trust thinking? Is that part of the, or is it something different? I'd like your thoughts on that.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think it is consistent or can be consistent with public trust thinking. Economic benefit, and when you think of commercial fisheries, and certainly it's a huge deal in Washington as it was in Alaska when I worked there. The benefit that accrue, the benefits that accrue to those commercial fishermen, to the whole industry, you know, all of the places that money flows through the economic, that's a benefit of that resource, a use of that resource, as long as it's done in a sustainable way so that you're not over exploiting the resource. If the fishery is managed in a sustainable way, that's certainly consistent with public trust thinking. Where you start to get into the more challenging elements of that is when you're forced to make a decision, those allocation decisions between users. So you've met your first threshold in terms of public trust. Your decisions represent a sustainable exploitation of the resource. Now you step into the minefield of allocating how much of that goes to the seiners, how much of it goes to the trollers, how much of it goes to the sport anglers. You know, economics is certainly a legitimate component of your decision making there, but I would suggest it's probably not the only component, because some benefits are easier to quantify in terms of economics than others. You know, you can pretty easily say, well, you know, this certain tonnage of sockeye salmon gill netted represents at today's market prices, you know, this economic return, and this is how that's going to flow through the economy, and you can quantify that. What's the economic value of being able to stand on the side of a river and see a stream of sockeyes running upstream, or, you know, things like that? So that's where the trustee's judgment is going to have to come into play. And those are always going to be decisions that wax and wane, you know, just like any other political or value-based judgment that you make.
Thank you. Yep.
Barbara.
Thank you so much for coming. This is a subject that's been of interest to all of us in the short period of time that I've been on the commission. Implementation, however, is tricky, and I think there are, I know there's people in this room that say, you know, we've already done this, but at least from my perspective, this is all my opinion, if we've done it, we haven't done it well. And so how we are able, I think your last slide with the circle is the practical effects of this is what draw me on board, because I come from a legislative environment, and pretty much all we saw of fish and wildlife was conflict. Those traditional stakeholders love nothing more than to argue with each other and say, I should get this, and you should get this, and you guys should do it this way, and basically throw the department under the bus while they're doing it. And I think we are suffering from that now. So that, for my interest, has been practical, although you bring out some very important ideological factors in here, and I think Jay Keeney spoke of them perfectly. But for us to get public funding, we have to have public support. The question is how we get public support, and is our traditional users enough of the public? And I would say no. Now, my question is, I didn't mean to have that quite a long of a preface, but another good paper is it was funded by WAFWA, which is called Values Trust Cultural Backlash in Conservation Governments and the Case of Wildlife Management. And what's interesting to me in this paper, well, it's all interesting, but there was surveys done of 13 Western states. Without going into a whole lot of all of this, the thing that struck me is that Washington State was by far the highest. We're at 90%, I wish you guys could see this, of people in this state who believe that, the percentage of residents expressing preference for agency-governed approaches that represent and are funded by all. So that's us. We got 90% of these respondents of a big survey saying that. How do we... I guess we have to internalize it, but really, how do we get from us to that? Because if we get to that, wow, our problems are a little bit over. How do we do that? I mean, this all sounds good and well, but you got nine of us here, and I guess another question might be, have any state successfully done that? You had four that had, I'll shut up. You talk.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Baker, that's a challenge, and In the paper that I mentioned where I talked about the role of state agency professionals, one of the things I talked about in there was the importance of recognizing, particularly for professionals, but I think it applies to commissioners as well, that the most effective way to influence legislators is through the public, not directly. When I was developing that paper, and initially I was thinking, and referred to the trustees in that rubric of trustees versus trust managers. I actually had identified the trustees as legislators, because they have such a profound role as trustees, I don't think many of them recognize that, and they're certainly not very often held accountable as trustees of the Fish and Wildlife Resource. And when agency professionals or commissioners try to hold them accountable in that regard, which includes making sure that there's adequate funding to fulfill the mandate that you have as trustees, you're not going to be nearly as effective as the public, because that's who those legislators and politicians recognize as their, quote, bosses. And I think what makes it particularly challenging, and the current political environment has just ratcheted that up even greater, is that historically, to a much greater extent, I think, when legislators ran for office, once elected, they recognized that their constituents were the citizens living within the district or the state that they represented. Increasingly, at least my perspective, is that your constituents now, are maybe the people who voted for you, but really the people who funded your campaign, and those are the people that you're beholden to. Anybody else in your district or anybody else in your state that wasn't supportive of you as a candidate really doesn't get the same consideration. And until we figure out a way to break that pattern and get elected officials back to recognizing that no matter how hard you fight during the campaign, once the votes are counted, you have an obligation to everybody in your district, whether they voted for you or not, whether they funded your campaign or not. You represent that individual. So somehow we've got to figure out how to address that. And I think, you know, your discussions earlier this afternoon about improving your communication, engaging broader public, that's the way you're going to be able to influence those legislators who are making those decisions about funding and the policy sideboards that the commission operates under. So I would certainly encourage and support the direction that you were discussing earlier today.
Quick follow-up, because we...
The survey that you talked about that you administer to the agencies.
Yes.
How big a deal is that? Who does it? And does it cost money? And have we done it? I mean, I don't think Washington's done it.
No.
I said quick, but...
Well, I'll try to be quick, because I recognize we're late. It's not complicated to administer, and it's not expensive to administer the survey. The way we'd initially envisioned this was to spend 1 year developing this tool, this assessment tool, which we did in 2016, and then in 2017, 2018, our plan was then to train agencies in how to use the tool so that they could go apply it themselves. That second part hasn't worked out quite as well. And so we're sort of rethinking how we can best make the tool available and help agencies use it. What we've found is that in those states where part of the group that I've been working with has administered the survey and then had a 1 or 2 day workshop with the leadership within the agency to look at the results and figure out what it means, it's been very meaningful and valuable to them and helped them identify some priority ways to move forward. So in terms of the cost, I mean, if the agency decided they wanted to do that, you know, it would involve, you know, transportation for a couple of us to come to Washington, either to show you how to interpret the results or to help actually walk through those. So.
Thank you. We'll keep that in mind. And could you send those articles, those that you mentioned, the information to Tammy so she can send them on to us?
I'd be glad to do that.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris, and we'll look forward to a continued dialogue. Important stuff. Nice to hear from the
outside. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll end the regular recess.